Hello, everyone. Welcome to Random Encounter 294. My name is John Logan, and we're doing something a little bit different today. So if you have been paying attention to the site, or alternatively to popular culture right now, it seems like everybody is talking about Fallout. Fallout is a classic RPG series that takes place in a post-apocalyptic world after a nuclear war. It takes place a couple hundred years in the future. We've been talking about it a lot on the site. If you've noticed, we have a review of the show we're going to be talking about today, and we have retro reviews of Fallout 1, 2, and 3, and we have an episode of Retro Encounter talking about the history of the games. So today, we're going to just be talking about Fallout, the TV show. And joining me today is former Random Encounter host and professional actor and someone who works extensively in the television industry, Greg Delmage. Hey, Greg.
Hello, Donald. Do I sound like I'm in old-time radio?
Yes, folks, there is the talent you get from Greg Delmage.
Oh, God. You get what you pay for, folks.
Hi, I'm here. I'm here to talk about a cool TV show. Spoilers, it's a cool TV show.
It really is a cool TV show. One of the reasons I wanted Greg here is, first off, we like Greg a lot, and obviously Greg and I hosted Random together for, I think, a year and a half.
It was a good time. I wish I could have done more. It's just, life is changes, right?
Life is nothing but changes.
Mm-hmm. So it should be.
Yes, exactly. But
life never changes. Wait a minute. Always changes. There we go.
One of the reasons I wanted Greg here is because Greg is a professional actor, and Greg does work in the TV industry. So
yeah, I'm a professional filmmaker as well. So yeah, I'm in various filmmaker jobs.
Exactly. So the perspective that you have for this kind of talk is invaluable. And the reason why we're talking about Fallout is obviously because it's, you know, it's the technically
it's the latest.
Yeah, it's the latest entry in the Fallout series, which is a very long-running series of games. I'm not going to get into the history of it because I just recorded like an hour and a half podcast about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But just for those listening,
go listen to Retro Encounter for that.
Exactly. Very briefly, Fallout started in 1997. It was an isometric CRPG that
I felt really, it was older. My goodness. Yeah.
No, just 97.
Yeah. Right.
It really took off and Fallout 2 got released, and then there was Fallout Tactics. And Woo. Then a game that nobody talks about. And then Bethesda Interplay was having some financial trouble. So they kind of put their properties up for auction, I guess. And Bethesda won, and Bethesda created Fallout 3, and Bethesda in partnership with Obsidian created Fallout New Vegas. Then Bethesda released Fallout 4. And then of course we have Fallout 76, the MMO version of Fallout. And
so has it been its Realm Reborn yet?
Sort of.
To come around again. I wonder, well, I'm sure the show and the recent like release of Magic the Gathering cards and stuff maybe helping its hype again, maybe. Who knows?
I think so. From what I've heard, Fallout 76 has one of the best communities in any MMO, simply because the people who play it like actually genuinely want to be there. So they're like super helpful.
Which is
helpful.
Super contradictory to like the world of Fallout in general.
But weirdly actually in line with the central conceit of the game. The idea was the people of Vault 76, when they go out, they were supposed to be the best and the brightest, and they were supposed to help rebuild the wasteland. And of course, when the game started, that wasn't true at all. The people who, quote unquote, left Vault 76 were a bunch of yahoos who just wanted to set the world on fire. But now it's like people who have left Vault 76 are actually helpful and nice and want to help rebuild the world. So that's more in line with the canon.
It's kind of funny. What was the game you said no one wants to talk about?
Oh, a Fallout Brotherhood of Steel, the action RPG.
I forgot all about that.
Everyone did. In fact, they've released in the last few weeks, there had been a lot of hot conversations about the canon of the Fallout series, and someone working on the show, or maybe at Bethesda, released like an actual list of like, here are the games that are canon, and they're all there except for one. everyone wants to forget about Fallout Brotherhood of Steel.
That's right,
Greg. Before we continue with this, I'm just curious: what is your background with the Fallout series?
Yeah, I mean, to tell the folks at home here, I was looking forward to trying to join in on the Retro Encounter episode, but just there's too much life going on. I have a now 16-month-old that is this recording, and then a teenager, and then my mom and my grandmother were visiting, so there's just lots going on. So I just couldn't make it happen this time around, where I would have discussed all that. But yeah, my history with it, I think I first got in to Fallout, was Fallout 2. I think my best friend Pat had it. And then we also tried one. And then eventually did that really cool collection back when you could buy, you know, physical PC media. You could walk into your store. There was boxes with discs and manuals in them. You could buy PC games at a brick and mortar store. Who'd have thunk? And it had all three, one, two, and Tactics in it. And that's where I started playing Tactics, which is the only Fallout game aside from 3 that I've ever completed. I've gotten pretty far into, but I never actually got around to finishing it, oddly enough. And I haven't really gone back to do much in 1 because 2 is just superior in every way.
Yes.
So there's really no point except for just the history lesson. But it's the world enchanted me. 3 was a lot of fun, even though it feels just kind of like grungy future Oblivion, but it was still fun in its way how they use VATS in that. Tactics I love just because I love tactical games, and I liked how you got to like build out a party the way it kind of was different from how you do it in like the other CRPG ones. I don't know what it was, but it just really stuck with me. And I had a doctor who was a real good sniper. It was really fun. I haven't done 4, and I've done the tabletop board game. I was going to ask you about that one. Yeah, it's super cool. It's like one of those, if you've played them, there's many of them out there, like a light RPG where the game world progresses with you if you want it to. You can kind of do it like a mission by mission basis, or you can like carry your character through where I think things kind of affect it a little bit, like you can carry your gear forward and stuff like that. But yeah, you just kind of set out and explore the wasteland into different areas and crap happens as it would in the game. Like it do a pretty good job of interpreting the Fallout 2, 3 kind of mechanics of who knows what'll happen to you when you walk off into that direction and into a board game fashion. And you have other players, you can come together and fight, or you can come together and help each other. Like it's a very, very cool game. I have not played enough of it, but it's because it's easy to sink a couple hours into, but it's super neat. And that's kind of my extensive enjoyment of it all. Oh, and of course, when the phone gaming came out, the Vault, whatever the hell it's called.
Fallout Shelter.
Yeah, Fallout Shelter. Thank you. That was a lot of fun. Sunk a lot of time into it until it starts getting to a bit of like the, okay, you ready to pay to stop raiders from ruining your life? And I was like, nope, I'm not. Bye, game.
Yep. It was a fun little mobile title.
It was. It's still going, and it's very neat, but I just got tired of this. The gameplay loop wasn't going anywhere for me, and I was like, I've got other things I can play on this, and yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it was very cool. That was kind of the case in mid-2015, 16. Yeah, there was a lot of mobile games back then.
But that did feel like kind of like if any game belonged on VATS, that was it. I could see people playing that on their little thing. There's that game. Everyone gets to be a vault manager.
Yeah. Let's talk about this show. So Fallout TV, as I understand it, there's a little bit of history behind it. Todd Howard was looking to develop Fallout into a television show. Amazon bit, and the show was on Prime Video. If you're looking for it, it's on right now, all 8 episodes. It was created by Graham Wagner and Genova Robertson-Duarte, with executive producers Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy. And of course, Todd Howard is one of the executive producers making his first foray into television.
And I didn't look at a lot of that when I went into it, when you kind of encouraged me like, hey, you should watch this for this episode. And when I saw Jonathan Nolan's name come up, I'm like, oh, crap, well, that explains some things.
Yeah, Jonathan Nolan, for those who are listening, and Lisa Joy are the creators of Westworld. So it has some background in the sci-fi there. Also, Jonathan
Nolan is related to Christopher Nolan, yeah.
Yeah, his brother. And yep. Jonathan Nolan directed the first 3 episodes of the series. So Jonathan Nolan really did set the visual tone and the style that was followed throughout the rest of the show. Although, in terms of vision, I know that before we dive in here, if you're worried about spoilers, don't be. For the most part, Greg has deliberately watched the first 2 episodes of the series. I've watched the entire thing, obviously, of the reviews on the site, but we don't want to spoil everything. Yeah. So if there are spoilers, it's only going to be for the first 2 episodes.
Yeah, you're, and even then, like, it's so much world building more than anything that you're you're just kind of hear it and go like, oh, that makes sense. That's probably the conclusion I would have drawn within the first 5 minutes of watching the show. So yeah,
exactly. So let's just, I'll briefly walk people through the opening episode with a very, very brief synopsis of what happens. So the show opens up in a place that we really haven't explored too much in the world of the games, which is the day the bombs dropped. So it's 2077 And we have an actor played by Walton Goggins, who is brilliant in everything that he does.
Dynamite.
And yeah, no exception here. He's at a birthday party with his daughter. He is he appears to be a washed up cowboy actor who is just doing like personal appearances. And then a bomb gets dropped on L.A. and then more bombs get dropped on L.A. So then we see him take his daughter and hop on his horse, and they ride off. And then we cut to 200 years later, and we are inside Vault 33, which appears to be an actual peaceful, calm and successful vault, which is a rarity for Vault Tech. We meet Lucy McLean, who is a high achieving vault dweller and the daughter of the Vault 33 overseer named Hank. And she wants to help provide some more genetic diversity to the vaults. There are three vaults that are interconnected, Vault 31, Vault 32, and Vault 33. So an arranged marriage is set, and there's a trade that is set up with Vault 32, and the vault door opens to Vault 32, and it's revealed a bunch of vault dwellers. So look a little worse for wear. Apparently there was a crop failure in Vault 32, and this is the first time they've been out. So they have this big wedding dinner, and it's Lucy's wedding night, and her husband is a good-looking guy, and they hook up. And then her husband tries to stab Lucy, and then the 32 vault dwellers start to slaughter the 33 vault dwellers. And it's revealed that they are not vault dwellers. They are, in fact, raiders that have managed to somehow get their way into 32 when we're posing as the population of 32. So Lucy manages to fight off her husband in a very gruesome way. And unfortunately, Hank, the overseer, is kidnapped by the raiders and taken to the surface. And Lucy decides to go against the directive of the Vault Council and goes up to rescue him. In the meantime, we meet up with a gentleman by the name of Maximus, who is a initiate with the Brotherhood of Steel. And he wants to be a knight. And the path to there is you have to become a squire first. And I'm not going to really, well, we'll talk about this when it comes, but he manages to become a squire to a knight. And in the meantime, we also meet the ghoul, who is apparently a future version, a ghoulified version of Cooper, the actor who we met in the very first scene.
Doesn't really get revealed, but it does. It's pretty obvious.
It's implied. Yeah. He was buried in a grave hooked up with some Radaway, and they dig him up, and he's not a feral. And he there are these three bounty hunters who are like, we want your help to track down this scientist from the Enclave. And he shoots all of them and takes the bounty for himself. And that's the end of the episode. So yeah, lots of plot threads. Here. Yeah, yeah. So many plot threads, but a lot happens here. And realistically speaking, Greg, you've played a bunch of the games and you sort of know the setup.
Yeah.
Most of the setups start with in a vault and with whatever the vault is in the games that you start out as a vault dweller. Mm-hmm. For the most part.
It's always the safe training wheels.
Yeah, exactly. It's a narratively speaking, it's a really useful way to start because then you have.
Absolutely.
You have someone who has been sheltered and has no idea what's going on the surface. And then you get the moment where the vault door opens and they can't see anything because it's too bright. And then the world is revealed. The wasteland is revealed in front of them. Mm-hmm. It worked in all the games and it works really well here too.
And what's most poignant for me was in 2 in the opening video sequence where they had that whole, the family is going to leave the vault and then a bunch of Brotherhood of Steel dudes gun them down. Mm. That always stuck with me too, where I was like, do I want to leave the vault? Who are these? Because you don't know anything unless, and I didn't play enough of 1 to know if Brotherhood of Steel or whatever was a factor. So yeah, I didn't know who these people were, what was going on. And I kind of liked that subplot, but like it didn't come to pass. You get to go out and do your exploration and such. And yeah, you just don't know what you're going to get coming out of the safety net of the vault, but it's a good conceit to like let you figure things out. 3 played it really well with the whole like you're going through your training, and I think they did a great job of amalgamating that into or interpreting that into the TV series with her running down like basically her character creation of like ticking hilarious. The points. Yeah. Like basically ticking the points into like, I'm good at my physical combat. I'm good at this. I'm good at that. This is why I'm a suitable marriage candidate. And it basically goes through like all like you would all the, yep. the points of stats you would put into building your character in VATS, which was hilarious.
I think that her perks were repair, science, and speech.
Oh, did that come up? Like, I guess it kind of did, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. In the interview. And what's hilarious is later in the series, no spoiler about the specifics, but like you get to see her do what would effectively be speech checks.
Oh, that's super fun. And I loved, like, and how they establish her character, her can-do, bright, perky attitude, and that comes up in, like, the next episode, too, about, like, how each vault kind of had a focus, which has always been a thing throughout the series, too, and how, yeah, hers was so focused on meritocracy and doing the right thing, which is good, too, because, as players historically know, Fallout does a very good job of giving you a lot of choices. So if you want to be a mass murderer who blows the bomb in Megaton, go for it. But if you want to be the hero and help people out, you can do that, too. But this one, by throwing that in there, they forced it, like, no, Lucy's going to be a good person, so far as we know. I mean, again, I'm only two episodes deep, so who knows, she could have a twist. But at the moment, her society raising has based her to be a hero, so we know we're going to go on this hero's journey. And I think that was very smart of them to do that.
I agree. One of the things that I raised in my review, this is my interpretation of it, but this is what I imagine they talked about. There are three main protagonists in this. So you have Maximus, the ghoul, and Lucy.
And I'm curious how all that comes together.
I think that all three of them, you've gotten a taste in the next episode. I think all three of them are basically the three different ways that a player of Fallout would play the game. So you have positive karma, neutral karma, and negative karma.
Yeah, I see. Okay, yeah, I definitely see what you're going for. Because I was wondering, and again, maybe they'll come together and have, like, they'll fight a common enemy and whatever. I wasn't sure if they were setting them up like this is going to be the party, or if, yeah, they're just going to be, these are just the three people we're focusing on. They may or may not like each other. We don't know. I mean, there's a bit more going on in the second episode where there's definitely some friction between them, but I don't know after that point where they go. But that's a great point that you bring up.
Yeah, because we're not going to talk about that far in the future, but just based on where Greg is at, like, you get to see, as he said, Lucy is really a positive karma protagonist through and through. Like, she believes in American exceptionalism and American values, and that a can-do spirit and a cheerful disposition can accomplish anything.
Which is, like, the foundation of that 1950s ideal of America that is, and 60s ideal of America that's kind of touted in like the background of the past that was in Fallout.
Yeah. She's a good person.
Yeah.
And
but she gets over her moral struggles real fast with the I love her catchphrase of okie dokie.
Okie dokie.
I guess we're gonna murder. Okay, whatever. And, like, just has to deal with it, like, here. Yep. Because it's this is the best means to an end kind of thing. But yeah, like, she's okie dokie is her, that's going in my own personal vault. I'll deal with that in therapy later, maybe.
Yeah. And I mean, that's part of the reason why I think the character works so well. It's a classic thing. It's when the ideals of a character are challenged, and it's,
which happens in this game so fast, in this series so fast. Yeah.
Yeah. It's difficult to imagine a more harsher challenge to a good protagonist than The Wasteland.
And that's always been what it does to you, right? Like, different games have had different setups for sure for that. But yeah, it's always, you come out and then it's just like, oh man, am I going to just try and run this place because it's just such a mess? Or am I going to try and fix it? Or am I just going to kill everything? Like, you know, you have all these choices ahead of you, and it's exactly it. Cause it's not nice.
Yeah. And then you have Maximus, who is, I would argue, a neutral karma protagonist, which is, he isn't necessarily,
I can't see that.
He's not a good or bad person, but he knows the realities of living in the wasteland and will make choices both in the second episode, and he'll make choices based on the circumstances that he's provided with rather than
best suit him.
Yeah, exactly. And then you have the ghoul, who is just clearly a negative karma protagonist who will do whatever it takes to achieve his goals regardless of who suffers.
And that's what I wanted to speak to. So going back to that first episode and the open of, like, the of D-Day, friggin' just broke my heart.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's, like, explaining, like, his history. He has a military history, which it kind of speaks to why he's so damn good as a bounty hunter. Also, can I get whatever his friggin' hand cannon is in the game? Like, shotgun with deadly accuracy from, like, 100 yards that just blows people apart. I was like, where do I find that gun in the game? It's ridiculous. And the sound it makes, like, that goes right up there with Jango Fett's sonic bombs. It's a very satisfying sound. Men only want one thing, and it's disgusting. It's those sound effects.
Yeah, whatever he is using is definitely the equivalent of a legendary weapon with a number of specials on it.
Good gosh, it's super. So that back to that opening scene, like they're talking about his history and then the idea of like what bombs get dropped, and he's explaining something to his daughter about like what to do and how to possibly survive the explosion, and then it happens and she does the thing, and I'm just like, and as a parent I was just like and just seeing him try to deal with that, and then he's like, we got to get out of here, and then just more bombs, and you're just like, well, okay, I see what's going on. And it's, and that's like it, I'm assuming more of that's going to get revealed somehow, but I can only imagine that's why he has become what he's become. Because, you know, so far it seems like she didn't make it. I don't know, but that just sucks. It's very much kind of like The Last of Us sort of setup, where the kiddo leads to lack of kiddo leads to jaded guy. So we'll see. But like, yeah, that whole opening scene was just heartbreaking for me when it got to that. But, I did love it.
I did too. And one of the things that I really love about the characterization of, I mean, they're the same character, but we can actually sort of break them down as there's the ghoul and there's Cooper, like 200 years apart. They're very different people that by that point, but
absolutely,
there are certain character traits that carry through. And I think with Cooper, one of the character traits that the ghoul shows off later is the ghoul doesn't lie. The ghoul doesn't bullshit. And even though this is his daughter, he doesn't bullshit his daughter. He doesn't tell her stop, drop, and roll. Everything's going to be fine if you do this. He does a thing with his thumb where he says, you put your thumb up, and if it's smaller than your thumb,
the explosion,
if the mushroom cloud is smaller,
the
mushroom cloud is smaller than your thumb, you run. If it's bigger than your thumb, there's no point. And he just tells her this.
Accept it.
And it's, and then she tries to fight it.
Yeah.
And says, and she's like, oh crap.
But like, she clocks the bomb first, which is, again, heartbreaking.
Great moment, too. Cinematography wise.
He set it up beautifully. The framing of that shot, the setting was really well established, where it's like this kind of modern, but also still a bit of that 50s kind of view. I did lean into it as hard as I thought they might. One thing I found interesting from a performance perspective was, they didn't have the actors hit that super like 1950s style of acting that I might have expected them to try and do. Everyone played it very modern, which I'm not sure how I feel about it. Cause everyone, like all the actors were great. Even the people helping set up like who Cooper is, the dick dad, all that sort of thing. Like everyone was great, but I'm not sure how I felt about it as a stylistic choice for the world. But either way, it did the job. Cooper's outfit looked great. Like he definitely looked like one of those like sideshow cowboys. like at that point already, you could tell the quality of the show from a design perspective, from a vision perspective, from the cinematography choices. The visual effects are fantastic so far, just in those opening moments. Yeah. So you like you already know you're going to be in for something pretty great. Clearly, Amazon through whatever Jeff Bezos budget they could add it. Say what you will about Amazon, at least they make good TV.
I imagine the budget for this is similar to the budget they used for Man in the High Castle in terms of like creating this believable world.
Great show.
Yeah. Amazing production design too. Like,
it's fun fact, my wife, when I was talking about her, you and I were talking in the pre-show, but my wife had a rap party last night. She was working with Mayumi Yoshida, who played the Japanese princess in Man in High Castle.
Oh, that's cool.
It was her first feature film, I think, that she was directing.
That's really cool.
Yeah, fun small world.
Yeah, it's the thing about the design in that show is that it is obviously it's less fantastical than Fallout, but it's similarly it's set in a different world. So they have to really imagine what would be a realistic version of the 1960s if the Nazis had won, and they succeed brilliantly. And one of the things that I think is genius about this show is, and frankly speaking, there's a part of me that still can't believe they pull it off. The production design is the production design of the games. Like there is no adaptation here in terms of, okay, we need to make this more realistic. This doesn't work. This is clearly exaggerated. Like it's gamey. We need to fix. No, everything that you've seen from the games, from the design of the vault to stim packs to vault suits to everything is here exactly the way limbs. It looks. It's exactly the way it looks in the games. And what's astounding is it works.
Absolutely, because, well, and those games were in their way grounded in reality, be it a stylized version of it, like, but it was still very believable. But speaking to that, what I find is stylized, because I've gotten to a point in my life for one reason or another, maybe it's just because I'm getting old. As of this recording, I turned 40 on Monday in a few days, so 2 days. And
so when this episode comes out.
Yeah, I'll be 40.
Happy birthday,
Greg. Hey! I've gotten away from like the really gratuitous, like hyper realistic, hyper violence in games and shows. There's certain things I find if it suits the story and fits the world, whatever. But other times, if it's like this was not necessary. You just put this in for the sake of putting it in, and like it just it's a turn off. Like I was watching Last of Us, loved it. I was playing Last of Us though, and when you start like stoving in someone's head with like your foot, and I'm like, that wasn't necessary. Like you didn't need to focus the camera on it. I would have got the idea if it was out of frame, you know, but anyways. So one thing I find they do really well here is it's violent. Spoilers. Fallout is violent.
The show is brutal.
It is, but it doesn't affect me because that's the one place where they did keep it kind of gamey and stylized. It's so over the top and like almost cartoony. That's the one thing that I didn't find was super grounded, that it's like lets me go like, oh yeah, that's just silly gamey violence, you know, like, and it fits the ridiculousness of the world and how like, yeah, like the VATS combat and all that stuff sort of works and critical hits and everything. Like, so I wasn't turned off in the same way and by so much modern media that does throw violence at me.
I agree. It's so, in many places, it's so over the top. I think, I can't remember, like if we're talking about perks in the game, then clearly the ghoul has taken the bloody mess perk where enemies will just explode when he hits them with a gun.
Yeah, and it's ridiculous.
It's so over the top and cartoony, like you said, that it's a super stylized version of violence.
Yeah, and so my brain kind of goes like, it's not real. So it doesn't feel as visceral and as sensitive.
Mm-hmm. And it's undercut. It's undercut slightly too in comedic moments, especially like in the first episode with the vault. Like my favorite is one of the vault dwellers who is the pregnant best friend of Lucy. Like she gets it. Her husband dies, and she has she gets stabbed in the face in the eye with a fork.
Oh my goodness!
And rather than remove the fork, she just picks up a machine gun and starts attacking the raiders with the machine gun, with the fork still sticking out of her face. And like violent image, but also later hilarious.
Eye patch, possibly.
Yeah, also hilarious.
Yeah, like she was. It was a mama bear turn. It was super funny, as you said, like the gruesome fight with her and her bow, and how she kind of gets away from him, and the makeup work is pretty fantastic in that. Again, from a stylized point of view, and I kind of loved, speaking of back to that fight in the vault and everything too, how they had like a projector for like their Oklahoma background in their cornfields and stuff like that to give them a sense of being outside. And like the classic, like thing starts going wrong and the tape starts burning up, and then almost like mirrored the nuclear explosions.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was really
that was a poignant parallel. You're right.
Yeah, I thought it was really neat. I was like, oh, that looks like this. I don't know if that was on purpose or just happenstance, because that's what happens when film gets burned up like that. But like, it really looked like, oh yeah, her world's now on fire the same way the old world was. I was like, that's really neat.
You're right. That was a really nice parallel. You know, I'll tell you the reason. One of the reasons why the portrayal of the folks in 1977 didn't really, like, they were acting like, it was naturalism. It was acting. They felt like it was today. There was nothing stylized about the acting. The reason it didn't bother me very much, and I agree with you, it would have been nice if there was a touch of it, but I thought it contrasted very nicely with
whatever.
Yeah, it contrasted very nicely with the behavior, with the acting of the vault dwellers in Vault 33. Because
yeah,
the vault dwellers
right.
In 33, they grew up with this idealized version of it, with the G-Shucks.
I guess they leaned into it. Yeah.
Yeah, because they really were. They acted like they were in the 50s, and like an idealized version of the 50s.
Yeah. Yeah, I get what you're saying. You're right. And that probably was the style, the choice to give that juxtaposition. So it really stood out when like, oh, these people they're that. Okay. Mm-hmm. Which, when people of the past weren't that, actually.
Yeah, clearly.
Which is
not.
Why the bombs got dropped, because they were, you know, they didn't have that come together attitude.
I mean, people in the 50s were just like they are today. We just everything is through a film filter.
Filter? Yeah.
Everything is seen through a filter.
Absolutely. We haven't changed just how we do it.
Yeah. And it's interesting. The design, I know you never played it, but the design aspects here, there are touches from other games, but they really do pull from the design of Fallout 4 and Fallout 76, which does tend to be a little bit more of a pastel version. Less. You mentioned earlier, like the Fallout 3 was like, it was dirty.
It was.
Yeah.
Very greedy, very brown.
I liked that because it was a much more... the future didn't seem quite as well scrubbed, but like the version of the vault here is very clearly inspired by the Fallout 4 and 76. Mm. But then once we get to the wasteland, it almost takes on a much more, I like what I said with filters. Like it takes on a filter that's a little bit more like, I guess the original Fallout 1 and Fallout 2 and also New Vegas, in the sense that it doesn't feel scrubbed. This feels like a very well-worn world. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Well, and three, I think three did a good job of that too, to be honest. The Capital Wasteland's pretty gritty. And like you can see, yeah, where they pulled those assets basically right in and filmified them, so to speak, like just the scale and whatnot. Oh, I was so happy when I saw the Bedarin.
Yes, that was cool.
And that's a lot of practicality to that. Sorry.
I know. Cutting you off.
Like there's so much, there seems to be this pushback in Hollywood of like not fully embracing the, like going full Mandalorian with like the LCD screens and going full volume, full green screen, full digital. Mm-hmm. Like we saw, anyone watched Andor, did a brilliant job of kind of marrying the two in bits and pieces. But I don't know, a lot of people can still tell it's not there. It's not one to one. The disconnect can be too much if it's used too egregiously. And like some shows have done it where it's too much when they get too much computer generated stuff going on. So I love that Fallout again is making the happy marriage of just the right amount, but most of it seems pretty practical, which sure is pricey, but the world feels real. It feels lived in. It feels grounded.
I agree with you. It's funny. You obviously have a very different perspective of this than I do because you work in TV and film. But I always found that not always, certainly not always, but films from I'd say the late 1990s, early 2000s that started using CGI, it uses it in a way that augments the real world, not replaces it. And as a result of that, the CGI itself has much more weight. It has a weight to it. Like if you watch, the pioneer of this was Jurassic Park, the first Jurassic Park. Like the dinosaurs in that, a lot of them are practical, but like a lot of them are also CGI. But in places where they're CGI, they feel heavy. And that's something that a lot of modern CGI has seemingly lost. Like they feel like characters in a video game, whereas like in the 90s and 2000s, those characters had a weight to them.
Yeah, like that whole what I like to call the visual effects jerk off sequence in Superman, where there's there's like a whole like half hour fight with him and his
Zod.
Zod, yeah, like. That was just 20 minutes of just this VFX team being like, look at what we can do, which wasn't the case. It was clearly like a director choice, whatever. Like, I don't want to disparage them. They did great work. But
wait, you're saying that Zack Snyder makes choices?
Yeah, but he does. He makes choices.
He does make a lot.
It becomes too much. You check out. The figures start looking just a bit too rubbery. You know. Like, yeah, Henry Cavill isn't flying through buildings and everything else. So eventually your brain just checks out of it once it gets to be too much. And you get that bit of like that rubbery, jointy kind of stuff where it gets a little too uncanny. And because whatever it is, I don't know if it's budgets, time, whatever, like that lets the VFX team not quite narrow out those kinks. Maybe it was technology at the time. But I think you're right. Yeah, in the early days where they recognize like there's no way we can make this one-to-one. So we just have to use it a bit more subtly. And in spots where it just, can augment things to give us a bit more life or motion or whatever, and then quickly go back to the practical because no one's going to buy it if we use it too much, right?
Exactly. And I mean, that's the case here. Like all of the props that you see, like if there are Pip-Boys. And what was cool is they didn't just have one generation of Pip-Boy either. Just like the games, they have like different generations of Pip-Boy floating around. Like Lucy has like a much more modern version, but one scene she goes into like a shop that has a bunch of Vault-Tec merch. And it's like, there's an older version of a Vault Boy hanging in the window. And it was just right. Like, oh, that's really cool. And everything looks identical to the games. Like the production design The prop designers must have had so much fun being like, okay, how do we translate these things into reality? Set deck.
Yeah, the set decor, as someone, like, that's one of the jobs I do as a day call most often here when I'm not acting and trying to get other film work, is doing set deck, which is set decorating, where we just go in and we're given a spec to figure out where things go and how to kind of tell the story of the background, essentially. And that's slightly different from props, very different departments, because props is basically the same stuff, but if an actor uses it, if they don't use it, it's set deck. And and so, like, I was impressed by the set decor, and it would have been like a set deck dream to work on that show for sure, because of the production design, because of, as someone who's a fan of the series, it would have been super cool too to be able to put in all these little Easter eggs. And I was just trying to get through it to make sure I watched it before this show, this episode recorded, but I do want to watch it again with Annette, because she's interested, and I think I'm going to look a bit more to find where there's little things here and there. But I loved, this catching the Pip-Boy bobblehead, and and then there's the other one later that I was really mad. I really think they could have shot that better, and I feel like they probably did, but it got the edit probably didn't make it, or got cut or whatever, when it's clear that Pip-Boy judges her, and so she makes the decision she does. I just think they could have shot that to make that a bit clearer, but it, clearly I got it, so it came across, because I knew what they were going for. But I thought that was really funny. She makes her choice.
One of the coolest things about the show, we talked about a lot about the production design and things like that, but again, they do a one-to-one, and you have power armor in this show. And
it's incredibly well done.
It looks really good. I imagine that it is a mix of practical and CGI. I think it
probably has a few little things, to like iron it out. But like for the most part, they're not CG people. Like they're moving, it's real people moving in lighter weight, I'm sure. But it's still clunky as any cosplayer would make, 3D printed or Warbla, whatever that foamy stuff is. Where it's awkward to walk in, but it's cool.
I recall last year, I can't remember which show, maybe it was a Summer Game Show, like they came out to promote Fallout, maybe it was even to announce it, and like someone came out in a set of T-60 power armor.
Dope.
And it looked, you were like, okay, that looks really cool. And it did look a little bit like a cosplayer. But the funny thing is, when you have a little bit of money behind it, you can take
more.
Yeah, you can take a really good piece of cosplay and just tweak and sharpen it up a little bit. And that's, again, what I love about really good CGI. It augments reality. It doesn't replace it.
And that, exactly. That's totally it. Speaking back to that shop too, how much do we love Ma June?
No, she's great.
Dale Dickey is so good.
She is.
I was like, can she please join the party? I want more of her. I mean, and her yelling at Barb. But it was...
Well, why don't we talk about the performances here? Like, we obviously talked a little bit about Lucy and Maximus Walter.
The leads, again, the leads carry the show beautifully so far. They're all wonderful in what they do. Also, Walter's ghoul makeup is really cool. I'm pretty sure his nose is CGI, though. I think I see the seams sometimes, very rarely. I'm trying to tell him, like, is it just really good prosthetics over top of his nose, or it's probably prosthetics but augmented with some invisible effects. But he looks great. I think that's pretty fantastic. And their performances are great. You're not going to be disappointed with wooden actors carrying the series. But yeah, the extra stuff.
They're great. But I mean, like, okay, well, let's just talk about Kyle MacLachlan. Kyle MacLachlan is a national treasure in every way, in my opinion, based on his performances ranging from Blue Velvet to his work with David Lynch for years and years.
Speaking of the popularity of Dune these days.
Yeah, exactly. You know what's funny?
Paul Atreides.
You know what's funny? A show that I think is unnecessarily maligned, because I actually think it was a pretty damn good show, was Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I really liked Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
It had its legs. It had its moments. It was in and out. I watched a bunch of it too. Yeah.
It was in and out, but...
Oh, right. He was Lucy's dad.
Yeah, in the third season. Oh, and he was so
good. And now he's
so
Lucy's
good.
Dad again.
Yeah.
I didn't realize he's two Lucy's dads.
And it was so funny because I was watching this and there was a scene where it really is the G-Shucks kind of 1950s dad, which Kyle MacLachlan does brilliantly. But then there is an element where he is extraordinarily good at letting the mask slip and just showing that there is a level of brutality underneath it. And there's a level of brutality when Lucy's quote unquote husband comes. She doesn't manage to kill him. She just extremely badly maims him. And then Hank shows up when and drowns him in an apple bobbing barrel. Or was it, no, it was a pickle barrel.
But also, and there's a moment there where if my kid was threatened.
Yeah, there's a moment there where the mask slips and it's just like,
this is why he's director or overseer.
There's a moment. Well, that's the thing. And also, this isn't a spoiler either. He's an overseer of a vault. And as we all know with vault tech, there's always something else going on under the surface. There's always an experiment. Yeah. And we don't know what the experiment in Vault 33 or 32 or 31 is yet.
No, but there's a character that hints at it, but
there's gotta be something going on here. So when Hank lets the mask slip, there's a moment where you're like, okay, maybe there's something else going on. And also, like, why would they kidnap him if he was just a random vault overseer? Like, what is the point?
Well, exactly. There's clearly a reason that they're after him, because where they came from, they did away with the other vault overseer. So he wasn't as important as this one was for some reason.
And that's
okay. And I'm seeing where she's from. Sorry, I was curious where the lead, Ella Purnell, was from. And Yellow Jackets is what I think put her on the map mostly. But she was also in Star Trek Prodigy. She did a voice.
She was Gwen.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I haven't watched Prodigy yet, but Yellow Jackets.
You should watch it with. You want to know what? Gwen would actually probably really like it.
She might.
It's a little. It's weird. The first 4 to 5 episodes of it feel like a Star Wars animated series. Like,
oh, funny.
Like the tone of it feels very much like Star Wars Rebels. Yeah, it feels very much like Rebels. And then like in the latter half of the season, it's like, oh no, this is Star Trek. And it's pretty damn good. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, it's a shame it got canceled.
No, sort of. Paramount didn't cancel it. They shopped it around and then Netflix picked it up. And there's going to be a season 2. And apparently there might be a season 3.
On Netflix. That's so weird. Stop diluting the streaming waters is weird. Anyways, give us one place to go, damn it. But anyways, back to this. So yeah, Hank, yeah, the mask drops. There's clearly something else going on.
Yep. And also like one of the things I liked about it, we talked about the slightly stylized 1950s acting in the vault, but like all of the vault dwellers, especially like later in the season, you're going to see like a lot of these characters are further developed. And I really think it's cool that like these characters that are just borderline glorified extras, like really do develop into some fascinating characters. Like these don't just feel like NPCs, like background with no character. They feel like actual people.
Well, and they'd have to in a TV show for sure. Like they'd have to let the world affect them in a different way. Than
like you have
in the game going
Lucy's
back
brother,
to
Norm.
The script.
Yeah. You have Lucy's brother, Norm, who is kind of comes across as a bit of a coward, unengaged, doesn't care about everything kid. And then starts to uncover levels of what's going on in the vault. And you start seeing elements of a heroism that is a little reminiscent of Lucy, actually.
Yeah, I could see that.
Then you see Chet. Oh, poor Chet.
Yes. I loved seeing, it was kind of funny seeing Johnny Pemberton when they went over to the Brotherhood of Steel. Because seeing him picking on Maximus and being a dick there in his voice, I have a hard time separating him from the idiot he played in Superstore.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really weird seeing him in this, but it's nice seeing him doing it's something different. But he's so frozen for me as I forget his character name in that show, but in Superstore. But it was it's nice seeing different people. Actually, I think Zach Cherry was in that too, wasn't he? Maybe he wasn't. Was he in Superstore? I can't remember. But he plays one of the he's one of the council. Get rid of these Cherry's Jubilee. We're being under attack, whatever. That guy was really funny. I am curious to see if she gets back to the vault or whatever happens there and is able to see these people as they grow and change, if that's a thing. And because some of them do survive the attack, of course, so they get to carry on. But they're going to be forever changed. Like their happy little ecosystem has been altered. And then there's, of course, the choice that Lucy makes. So I'm very curious to see where that goes.
Yeah. And you get Ma June, Dale Dickey, who is just great in pretty much everything, but like is real good here.
And then there's the other curious person, there's a scientist who's kind of like, is that Moises? No, that's not. No, it's not him. What the hell's the scientist's name?
Siggy Wilzig.
He's pretty great in what he does. And he's like the MacGuffin that kind of brings everything together. So I'm very
curious. He literally becomes the MacGuffin, actually.
But I'm curious like how his stuff fits in. He's the one who comes with your trademark, the dog companion, who's called Companion, which is great. And I'm glad to see things progress with that, with the dog. It's very touching, the relationship that's there, and very cute. Because you see kind of like, you see the brutality and the efficiency of the Commonwealth gets established a bit there too, because they don't, unlike so many of the games do, that hide the Commonwealth as a thing for so long. Yeah. At the gate, we see it. Like, people are introduced to that as part of the world, that there is actually somewhere an established sort of glistening remnant of society.
There is civilization of a sort.
Yeah, but it is, and definitely...
the Enclave is a brutal version of it.
Yeah, exactly. There's definitely a brutal, almost... I can't remember if they're a dictatorship or not, but it's definitely got some of those overtones.
Oh, no, Greg. They're not a dictatorship. They're the leftovers of the United States government. They're the actual government.
So it's nice that gets introduced right away as a thing, and it becomes part of the plot points that's happening. Mm-hmm. So, and that's the other thing, seeing like the Brotherhood of Steel is like the next thing that gets thrown in there, and we get to see so much more of like the zealotry and the structure that's involved in that, in terms of who the Brotherhood is, who the knights are, who the squires are, and like the religious aspects that seem to partake of that, like the extreme version of whatever. Like, they don't even outright say Christianity, but it's clearly rooted in that. And going forth and cleansing the world and bringing order back to it. But also, like, when Maximus is assigned to his knight, the outright boredom that power has brought him is ridiculous. Oh, yeah. And then also his disillusion. He basically just seems to be in it for the suit. The dick that he is, and then the decisions that get formed by Maximus in there, and all their names too, right? The names they're given: Maximus, Thaddeus, Titus. Like, it's very, very Roman Catholic. Like, it's Roman Empire-esque in its structure and its vibe, mixed with a bit of Christianity. It's very neat seeing some more of that, because you don't get a lot of that. You might have in the Brotherhood of Steel game that no one wants to talk about. And I feel like a bit of it was mentioned in, because I think you're part of the Brotherhood of Steel in Fallout Tactics.
But you're
more of ragtag. It's not as, you're like around the fringe. I can't remember how it all worked out. It's been a long time.
The Brotherhood, in the lore, the Brotherhood goes through a number of different iterations. I mean, like literally hundreds of years pass between iterations of the Brotherhood, and any organization would change in that. So there are times where, like you said, they are much more like a Christian organization. And then other times they're much more of like they're using the framework of medieval society but they don't have any like religious affiliations whatsoever. And then there are ones like in New Vegas, they are like super anti-gay, not because of religion, but because they want people to
procreate,
procreate. What you said about, okay, the character is technically the character is not dog meat. Technically, the character is CX-404, dog, but it's dog meat. Like, it's not the same dog meat in all of the games, but it's dog meat. Dog meat is
that's the vibe. Yeah.
Yeah. Dog meat is in almost every single game.
It's like the dog meat is the link of Fallout.
Exactly.
It's always a slightly different dog meat, but it's the same dog meat by spiritually.
Yeah. Right breed, right look. And one of the things I like about dog meat, this isn't really a spoiler, but like dog meat, I would say, is the ideal companion, because Dogmeat passes hands a number of times throughout the show, where it's just like Dogmeat is just like an awesome companion to whoever Dogmeat is with at the time. Is just like a good girl.
Yeah, she's a sweetheart, and we learned Stimpaks work just fine on her.
Yeah, which is an interesting moment, because there is a rule in narratives that any character that has a kick the dog moment instantly becomes an irredeemable character.
Yeah.
And like the ghoul does have a kick the dog moment in the second episode, where the ghoul stabs dog meat because dog meat attacks him.
Yeah.
And at that moment, I do feel like he lost a lot of sympathy. But then immediately after that, he goes out of his way to make sure that he heals dog meat and saves dog meat's life, which sort of fixes it, like counteracts it a little bit.
Almost. Because I had that. I saw that and I was like, okay. Like, he was clearly, it was like, sorry, dog. This was just business. You know, I was just saving my ass. And then, but, you know, oh, good. You're still alive. I'll save you. But at the moment, I haven't seen enough to know what happens. I also think it was a choice, because he knows the dog is going to return to his quarry, and he's chasing the scientist who has the dog. So I think right now he's trying to use the dog as a homing beacon. So he's not fully redeemed. I think it's a means to an end, as opposed to you're my new companion. But I am curious to see if we start getting this whole link between the two once, if they discover something as they go along, and then maybe the dog helps him redeem his humanity or something. I don't know. I'm very curious to see how that develops. But at the moment, he still hasn't fully won me over, just a little bit. But right now, it more just seems like it was because he clearly, there was a tenderness there. He clearly cared. But at the same time, it was also, good girl, you're going to take me to where I'm going. Yeah, exactly. There's pragmatism to it.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, when I was a writer, and I mean, you know this as well, as a writer and as a creator, if you want to create there are many different types of villains out there, but I would argue that the difference between a villain who is beloved by an audience and a difference between a villain who is loathed by an audience, it comes down to if it's personal. So like in this particular case, he stabs Dogmeat and then immediately heals him, but there's nothing personal about it. There's nothing that the ghoul is doing that feels personal. It's dispassionate. It's just business. It's what
he said. He's in it for the game. He likes the
exactly.
game.
And because of that, there's everything he does. You don't really attribute malice to the character. And so you don't hate the character. Whereas other villains, when they do horrible, horrible acts, it is personal. And if someone enjoys what they're doing, if someone enjoys the pain they inflict, that creates a very different type of villain.
Absolutely. And we're going to see some of those. I mean, it's almost why, it's almost why Titus was more villainous than the ghoul in his way, as people explore Maximus's story a bit. But it's, I find, if for people, again, speaking of video game shows, for people who are big fans of The Last of Us, whether the game or the show, you will find a lot of, I think, parallels between so far Cooper the Ghoul and Joel's character and their arc at the moment. So there seems to have been, they've replaced their humanity with something else to get by, you know, and it's got this sort of like, pragmatic brutalism. Whether it's tricking themselves into it or convincing themselves that like they like that life or not, to get to not feel kind of thing, you know? And when your ghoul has been around for 200 years and dealing with whatever it is, you've definitely seen things. It's a bit different from Joel, but like it's going to warp your sense of reality and purpose. But I still think there's all of it's a big band-aid, I think, with the ghoul. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to see how that gets torn off.
Well, I'd actually really like to pivot into talking about not specifically The Last of Us, but that idea of video game adaptations and what Fallout does differently. But just because you brought it up and we were talking about the supporting cast, I'd like to mention Cooper's daughter, Janie, the actor who plays her in 2077. I thought she was so damn good.
She was like, really great. She was very
in
compelling.
In the opening scene, there was a moment like when she holds the thumb up to the thing. There's like a moment where you're like, oh, that's. I bought the fear. It was.
Yeah. And that's a fine thing to get with child actors for anyone who knows the craft a bit better and knows what to watch for. Like, I know there's a big percentage of the population that watch shows and just don't care or don't care to notice. But there's also a big population in there that you know when something's true or not. And that's speaking as an actor, and you know this as well, that is our biggest job. It's not about going into an audition or a role and just trying to say the lines really well. We're there to tell the truth, which I know sounds a bit like actor mumbo jumbo, but it's true. We're there to be truthful because people will tell. People will know. Well, when people won't believe you, they check out, which is why so many people disparage stuff like Hallmark and stuff. But there's a ton of people that love watching Hallmark and Lifetime shows because they're not fully true. And those actors, they do what they can with what they have and with the style that they're kind of forced into as someone who's worked on a few Lifetime shows and stuff like that. Our most important job is to just tell the truth. And with kids, it's really hard because they don't have the life experience. So it's very hard for them to be thrown into these hyper stylized places or hyper reality moments and be told like, so you're seeing your potential death. Can you act that for me? And so many times what it comes down to is an acting coach or the director basically giving them the equivalent of what's called a line read, which is say it like this. Mm-hmm. And the kid will just pretend and ape that. And you can tell when they're just trying to do the idea of it, what they think it should be, and it doesn't land. And you get your Disney performances or whatever from Disney kids TV shows. Or you can get those really good actors like your Elliots from E.T. and stuff like that, or Dakota Fannings and such, who just – they have it. They have that gift. They can just sink into it and they can just deliver a real grounded, truthful performance that makes me so sad as an adult actor that I sometimes can't achieve at the same level that this kid is doing. But it's, yeah, and she's got it. She's got something. I really hope she keeps going and becomes an standout actor. I'm blanking on her name right now. I was trying to find her.
Tegan Meredith.
Yeah, I don't know what else she's done, but yeah, she was great. Like, she's a great gem that they found because she was believable. Like you were just saying, like, you believed the fear. You believed that she saw, I might die. Oh my gosh, mm-hmm. Dad, help me. And yeah, that's really hard to get out of kids because as opposed to just an aped performance. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
The thing that got me about her performance and the performance, I mean, this is an acting thing. And oh God, you get two actors talking about like what makes a good performance and it'll go on forever. So I don't want to do that. But the difference here and the thing that really got me about her, and this is something that was taught over and over in when I went to theater school and like I used professionally, and it was it's such a stupid line, but the idea of breath is life. And a tight performance that is a little bit unbelievable, it's like holding your breath. There's nothing there. It's like a static sort of thing. When she sees the mushroom cloud, she's breathing. And
yeah,
it's such a moment where show don't tell, but also like when you're scared, you don't stop breathing. In fact, if you really pay attention, your breathing gets louder in your ears.
Yeah.
Like you can hear yourself breathe. And that was a moment, and you saw it in Cooper too.
Yeah, his performance in that moment too was really great. Of like the what the hell am I seeing? To the mm-hmm. oh crap, am I seeing this? Oh my God, I am seeing this. I need to deal with this. Like that was a masterclass in just stillness and acting with what he gave there.
Yeah, it was, and I mean the brilliance of that performance was. You get to see just how good a dad he is at that point, because there's an instant like protector, do what you can. Like he just told her, don't run. You can't run. If it's bigger than your thumb, yep. You might as well not run. And he still grabs her and he still runs.
You got to try. You would. Yeah, it doesn't matter. As again, speaking as a dad, like that whole scene is just, it hits home for me and it was beautifully done. And it's the same thing. It doesn't matter how hopeless it is. Your human fight or flight instinct is going to kick in to try and do something about it.
Yeah. This is going to kind of fall into the discussion question, but you mentioned The Last of Us, which I would argue is prior to Fallout would be the gold standard of video game television adaptation.
Jono, have you ever seen Dungeon Siege?
No, I've not.
You have not seen Jason Statham as Farmer in his most brilliant role? Come on. No, I'm kidding. Anything by Uwe Boll that is video game adaptation is Uwe bullshit. So yes, exactly. I agree with you. Last of Us, whether you play the game or a fan of the game or whatever, is just brilliant TV on its own.
Yeah. And one of the things about it is it does take liberties clearly with the episode. It took two throwaway characters who were like an environmental side quest in the games, and it expanded them into a full episode.
One of the best episodes of television I've ever seen in my life. Outstanding yeah. performances, outstanding story arc, bawled my eyes out. Just mm-hmm. people, if you don't like that episode, why are you listening to this podcast? If you
if you don't like that episode, why are you an RPG fan? There are other sites for you.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh my gosh. Yeah. My wife and I just bawling, looking at each other, and it's like, oh my goodness, this whole episode is just incredible.
But the difference between Last of Us and Fallout was The Last of Us did a pretty much, there were places where it changed a little bit, but it was a pretty much one-to-one adaptation of the original game of The Last of Us. Whereas Fallout instead is an adaptation in that it takes place in the world of the games, but tells its own story using the factions and the world that has been set up. And I'm not saying that one is better than the other, but I really do like the freedom that the Fallout approach brings to an adaptation, where it doesn't feel like it needs to follow the characters that we already know. It uses yeah. that world as a setup. I like that. It provides much.
This smart.
Yeah, I think it's very smart. And I think that they did a brilliant job of, I say in the review that my only real problem with this series is that at points I found myself wanting to play it. Like I'm like, yeah. this is real good, and I would like to make choices that clearly I can't, because it's been filmed, and I don't have.
It would be a very weird, interesting choose your own adventure kind of story if they were able to interpret
this
that.
Like Bandersnatch, this isn't a Sega CD FMV game, unfortunately.
I remember I kind of had that after I watched the first episode, and partway through the second, I was like, oh, damn it, Jono, get me to watch this at this point. Now, like, all I want to do is go back and play Fallout 2 and whatever and try and complete things, which I do not have time to play more different games right now.
Want to know the truth, Greg? I know you haven't played it, but if you're looking for a Fallout game to play, give 4 a shot. I'll tell you some mods to download to improve the experience.
Yeah, I do want to play 4. I haven't. New Vegas. That's the one I really want to get into because I've heard too much good about it. And I'm so far gone at this point that I know it's all fixed by the community and whatnot. So I know I can get through it without bugginess. So,
From this, let's pivot to the discussion question now, because I don't want this episode to run too long.
No, but it's been good. Like, just good show's good.
Yeah. Well, let's do a little quick takeaway here. Fallout good. I really enjoyed it. It's only 8 episodes. It's a tight show. It tells a story, and no spoilers, but there are enough threads hanging off season 1 that it's very effectively going to set up a season 2 if it gets renewed, which
I'd be shocked if it doesn't at this point. It might already be, for all we know.
Yeah, it's getting pretty universal reviews, as I understand it. People are talking about it.
Yeah, exactly. It's earning its praise. It seems pretty unanimous across the board from the bits and pieces I picked up. I try not to because I don't want to spoil myself too much. Mm. It's got, again, a standout cast, a standout commitment to the production value, to creating this world, from performance to the stagecraft of it all. That it's great. I want to just go like walk through some of those, the city sets that they made and stuff. You see in episode 2 and like the blow apart stuff and everything that they got to like fight in and stuff. It was so neat. One thing we didn't talk about, but we should for a second before we completely go away from it, is we knew it was coming when we saw the cave, right? And Dogmeat in the cave and the bones, and then when Titus goes there, which also F Rappaport, F that guy.
Yeah, he did a real good job as like the most loathsome character.
Yeah, but he's also kind of a shitty human these days. But
really?
Just with his opinions on what's going on in Palestine and Gaza and stuff, kind of makes him not a pleasant human right now. But what are they called? Because they're not called bears. Uruguay. Thank you. Yeah, seeing one of those is in that. It was CG, but it's still super well done. So like, there's not a huge disconnect. So terrifying. Yeah. And really well done how they did the interaction between the CG and the real characters and stuff too, especially when he tries to do the play dead bear trick. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Super funny. Actually, but I love all that.
At that moment, remember how I mentioned the neutral karma? That was the point in the show, more than any other show, where I really did, as Maximus is sitting there looking at him, where I really did imagine the dialogue box appearing at the bottom, because he takes his time trying to figure out what to do. And I just imagine like there being a mouse switching between, okay, here's your stim pack, or go die, with the player being like, what am I going to choose here?
No kidding. Well, and just... it was a weird choice from that from the character who was asking for help to be like, I'm going to disparage the crap out of you, but still expect your help. Like, read the room, man.
Well, the performance, Aaron Moten's performance as Maximus, it's different than any other performance in the entire show. There's a quirkiness to the character where I don't quite. It's almost like there's something wrong with him and we don't know what it is yet.
Yeah, because like he's this guy's a newer actor. Like, this is definitely his breakout role in many ways. Well, that's not true. He's been in a couple other things when he was younger, but I think this is going to be what puts him on
this
the map.
The big one.
He's great so far. He gives me, honestly, a lot of John Boyega vibes as Finn in the Star Wars sequels. Very much like, you know, trying to be the hero, but also trying to preserve his own skin. And there's that constant struggle between the two at the moment. And there's definitely they haven't answered this question because you didn't really get into it, but it seemed something happened to a close friend of his that basically put them out of the running to be a squire. And he took his place. And it's not clear if he did it or not. And I don't know if that's cleared up later on into the later in the episode or not, or later in the series or not. I'm very curious to see. And I honestly, I can't tell, because his neutral stance of doing what's best for him in the moment, part of me says like, yeah, he totally did it. But also his genuineness in his interrogation when they were trying to figure things out makes me go like, no, he didn't.
There's a real question mark. His foundation
for what he wants. Yeah, exactly. Because he's the one who could dip either way. He could go Lucy or he could go Ghoul.
Is this going to be a hero or is this going to be a sociopath?
Absolutely. And right now, there's definitely some sociopath undertones for sure. Mm-hmm.
Oh, there totally are. And you're going to, no spoilers in terms of actual events, but you're going to continue to see that push and pull that makes sense. Throughout it.
Yeah, and that makes sense for sure. Because he definitely seems like he wants to do, well, and especially when he says like his whole modus operandi right now is to get revenge on the people that hurt him. That's a foundation for a sociopath. That's someone who wants to put hurt back onto the people. He wants to be judge and jury and executioner of who that is, which is fundamentally a screwed up thing for a human to do by themselves.
Yeah,
so there's his moral compass is going to be all over the effing place.
It's the kind of thing, like if he was in Fallout 3, I don't think he would blow up Megaton, but he'd think about it for a second.
Absolutely. If it served him.
Yeah, exactly. It's a really cool performance, and it will develop. I say in the review, again, no spoilers, but like Maximus arguably goes through the biggest character journey throughout the series of all three of them in a really interesting way.
With the other two being so polarized in what they are, I could see that being a bigger opportunity for growth, but that might be for the bigger arc of the series, not just the season.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the brilliant things about this show that the games reflect too, which is, there are a lot of different factions in the Wasteland, and loyalties shift very, very quickly depending on who benefits, what people need. And that is very much in play in this show.
Mm. Also, shout out to dude in his underwear. All this could be yours.
That was a nice little moment. That was that felt like a very much a throwback to Fallout. One or two, where it's just like there's just a random character who has no impact whatsoever on the plot, could very easily be cut out, but you talk to them and you're like, this is a weird little guy.
And that's just it. Like, I find in both episode one and two, they're doing a decent job of peppering in some of the erraticness of the Wasteland and what the games throw at you, just these random encounters you can come across. And like when Lucy steps into the old house and sees the plan D, whatever it was, in use. And again, heartbreaking, but also, yeah, that's a choice. That's something you could do. And also it's to set up something later. So that makes sense why they threw that in there.
And also in line with the games, which, especially the 3D games, absolutely excel in environmental storytelling, where you wander into a house and you see a story in front of you, a bunch of skeletons and a situation. And it's like, what happened here? And you might find out, you might not, but it's brilliant little vignettes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a smart choice to make sure they have that in there too. They're doing a really good job of not having, of using show don't tell exposition, of trying to world build and such like that, which is brilliant. And which is so far why the show, I think, is excelling.
Yeah, I actually thought that Plan D, I think that is, I'm almost positive that's never appeared in any of the games, but that is the most, like, of course Vault-Tec has a product called Plan D.
Well, absolutely. And I love how it gets, I love how it gets explained by the scientists, which, again, people will see. I don't want to spoil that. I think that's one to keep close to the vest for now. But I love how he's like, it's arguably their best product. And it's like, it's true. That should have been there somewhere along the line, because it makes sense. It's not everyone could handle the pressure of the end of the world, or that the end of the world might happen. So obviously there'd be a poison way out kind of thing, right? Like it's, you know, the cyanide pill in the tooth or whatever it is, you know. It's neat. But so anyways, all that being said, like, yeah, this is just, before we keep going on a diatribe about the merits of the show, it's pretty great. But what was your question you wanted to ask?
Well, what I wanted to ask was the discussion question, which was, first off, I personally, based on this and other things, I think that RPG series make for better TV adaptations.
Yeah.
Because they have a much more flexible structure. And also because factions are inherently a thing in RPGs like this, and factions can be very effectively adapted into a new story because you're not dealing with specific characters, you're dealing with ideologies and things that can be played off each other. So new scenarios can be created with these factions in a way that separates them from straightforward one-to-one adaptations. So I wanted to ask you, what other RPG series would you like to see adapted into a TV show like this? So like not a one-to-one adaptation, not like instead something that tells a brand new story in an already existing RPG world.
Yeah, because like we had that with not The Last of Us as an RPG, but like, you know, it's retelling a story that exists, or like The Witcher does that decently well to a certain degree, but it's also a bit more book heavy, but we have it. Yeah, I was trying to think about like, yeah, what would I want to see as this? Cause like there's so many cool things out there that would be worth translating into, a TV series for the people to see. And I think the biggest one that comes to mind, which I thought I'd heard was in development and I haven't looked to see where it's gone, but
you're
I think
the
biggest
one, you're going to say my choice.
I might. Horizon Zero Dawn.
Oh no, that wasn't what I was going to say, but you're right. Cool.
I would love to see Horizon Zero Dawn brought to the big screen. I would be sad that Ashley Birch wouldn't reprise the role, but I have a feeling they'd find some place for her to go into. But I think that story is fantastic, and I think it deserves to be shared with as many people as possible because it's such a well-written, well-conveyed story that people who don't play video games, who will sadly never get to experience it, I think deserve to see that story. And that's what I think is the power of a good video game adaptation, because those stories are great, especially with RPGs. That's what makes them so compelling for us, is we're like playing a novel, you know, we're playing through our favorite fantasy or sci-fi series or whatever. It's just a medium that not everybody can get into. And I think is why The Last of Us has been such a successful TV series, for example, because the storytelling was there. The world was there. The characters were there. It's just a different way to tell it now. And I don't, honestly, if people get so precious about it from the gaming perspective, that's on them. Like, it's not necessarily for them, because you've already got that. You've already had that experience where you were connected to how the story gets played and told through your interactions with it directly. This is for the people who don't pick up a controller and fiddle with analog sticks. Like, this is for the people who deserve to see a really cool story told by really great actors and writers. But anyways, Horizon Zero Dawn, I've always thought, deserves to be shown on the big screen. And I think now is the time for it. I think it would excel. I think it would look brilliant. I love that world. I love Aloy's story. And I would love to see, and the environmentalism future is very poignant of, you know, how, again, things could go so wrong with AI. I think it's very poignant at this point. So
it's a good story to tell.
Exactly. And I think it would be such a cool watch. And I want so badly to star the woman who was the raider in Solo, A Star Wars Story, the head raider at the very end there. I forget what the heck her character name is, but I think she was great and I want to see her do more things. And I think she'd be a good fit for Aloy.
And another nice thing about the Horizon series is that, like I mentioned, there are a lot of different factions.
There's lots of different angles for sure. It doesn't have to just be Aloy. Like, he can, deviate onto some other stuff.
Yeah. Mine is, I suppose mine is fairly obvious. Like, if I could pick any RPG series to be adapted into like a 8 to 10 episode premium series like Fallout, it would be Mass Effect.
Yeah. Okay. There we go. I was like, Monkey Island? I would also watch the crap out of a Monkey Island cartoon.
Oh no, don't do that to me. That would be too good. I would love to see, I know there's an anime version of it, but I would love to see like an Ace Attorney show, where every episode is a case. But no,
I'm surprised that Japan hasn't done that yet.
There's an anime version of it, but
I'm surprised there's not a live action version, because it'd be so silly.
There is. It's not a show, but it's a movie.
Okay, I thought I saw something about that. Okay, I'm not crazy.
Yeah, it's a movie. It's very faithful in story, not in tone, but super, super interesting.
Oh, neat.
It's cool. But no, Mass Effect.
Anyways,
because Mass Effect is, I don't think it should, I wouldn't have the show starring Shepard. I just
it'd
think
it'd be hard for them not to, though. Like, I don't know. Because I see your point, but like I feel like they would want it to be just because that is the thing about that series. I honestly don't want to disagree and step on you too much, but like, I don't know. I don't know if they could do it without him being the focal.
Oh, I think that you could. I think what you could do is if I was pitching a Mass Effect TV show.
Give me your elevator pitch. We're trapped in an elevator. Go.
Yeah. I would set it years and years and years before Shepard and this entire thing. I would have the show be them carving out the alliance.
There's a prequel
carving
thing.
Out the alliance between the races. And then you get like the back and forth and like, can you trust these people? And you get to see like friendships form and you get to see horrible choices being made for the sake of peace. Like, I think that has the makings of a really interesting television show right there.
Which would be pre-Earth, because Earth doesn't get into the council until the end of one, right? Because of Shepard's actions? Or is that right at the beginning? I forget now. It's been a hot minute since I played. I know that's part of it.
No, they get a position on the council at the end of one, but like Earth is known.
Yeah,
it is. Earth is known at that point.
And that's where I think it might be hard to do the prequel, because so often we are fixated on humanity's number one. So like us not getting to the point where we're part of the council might be a hard sell.
I mean, I think that'd be the cool thing though. Like you said it during or just after the war between humans and it's been a while Turians? Since I played the game too.
Was it the Turians?
Oh yeah, no, it was the Turians. So you it said it, like Turians. Right okay, after the war crazy. Between the Turians and the humans. Yeah. So you have a lot of really raw nerves there. So it's just like a political thing about them trying to a humanity trying to carve out our place in the universe. And you could still have humanity like at the center of it.
I wonder if they could do it and potential. Focus on Anderson.
Yeah, that's true. Anderson would be a good person.
Yeah.
Shame David Keith is a little old to play the role.
Yes, he wouldn't be able to do it, but there's plenty of brilliant actors of color who could do it.
God, you can't beat that voice, though.
No,
it's one of the iconic voices.
Yeah, and they'd find a way again to throw him in there.
Yeah, I mean, one of the major reasons that I want a reboot of Gargoyles is just so I can have more of Goliath.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I'm so cautiously optimistic about that.
Yeah,
and that's the other thing too. Speaking to these series, and again, why I think like, yeah, I don't know. I could see that having legs, but I don't know if an executive board would accept it not being about Shepard, since that is so key to the world at this point as we know it. Because the same reason why, like, you have the Halo TV series, which I haven't watched yet because I don't have Paramount Plus. I do want to check it out. It's apparently good enough to get a season two, so it's got some legs. But, like, there's no way they could have done it without Master Chief. Mm-hmm. Like, there was that cool... That being said, though, the movie that came a while ago that kind of almost was a proof of concept... That was more or less about the program of selecting Spartans. I think was watchable. It was good, and then having Master Chief show up at the end just made him a little more poignant, as opposed to you just being like, "Oh, there's Master Chief again." It was really neat having him finally show up and be like, "He's the thing. There he is. Oh my gosh, it's so cool seeing him real." Mm-hmm. I thought that was actually pretty well done. I mean, I'd watch the crap out of a Halo Reach series.
I think that's one of the reasons why Mass Effect would work without Shepard. It's because
and it could, yeah.
Mass Effect originally, I mean, in its first iteration, it was sort of a replacement for the Star Wars IP. I mean, Mass Effect is a spiritual sequel to Knights of the Old Republic in terms of its mechanics and gameplay. Right. They created a really interesting world around it. I think they could use that world in a more effective way than Andromeda did.
They could even do it as like the formation of like the N7.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. And I like Andromeda personally, but yeah.
It's very neat. Yeah, it's all good. And the other thing I was going to say, though, just because I wasn't sure you're going to say it, but I didn't think you would because it was not an RPG series. But I'm also excited that another story needs to be told is BioShock. But I think that is happening. And I hope it is given the same level of care as both these two series we've mentioned chiefly, because BioShock is a brilliant story again that I think people could benefit from seeing. It's just so good.
If people out there want a... Oh God, I can't believe I'm about to suggest this to people. If people out there want an actual video game TV show, I highly recommend you check out Remedy's Quantum Break from 2016, which is not just a video game in the style of Alan Wake and Control, but is also a full-out TV show as well. That was filmed at the same time and like is integrated into the game. It's sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but it's really cool that they were trying back then.
Weird.
It's really cool. Like at the end of every episode, at the end of every chapter of Quantum Break, you basically just watch it like a fully developed with actors TV show. and it's that will shape the future events in the series. It's really interesting. And like, there are branching paths in the TV show. So you like pick the version of the TV show based on the choices that you made in the previous episode. Neat thing.
I also, now that
didn't quite work, but neat thing.
Now that we've talked about this, I also would love to see a, in the form of like Star Wars Visions or Marvel What If.
Oh yeah.
So having an anthology based around Legend of Zelda. So all these people who Link traipses through. So like, you know, just this couple having dinner in their house and he comes through, smashes their pots and leaves kind of thing. But like, just like little silly stories like that of how they interacted with the Hero of Time, mm-hmm. I think would be a really funny, like 6 or 8 episode series of just in like Breath of the Wild world or something like that, mm-hmm. of Link wandering through their, into their lives and affecting them for better or worse, usually for better. I think would be the better way to do this, of course. I think that'd be a really fun series too.
You know, it'd be an awesome anthology series like that based on what we were just talking about. That's really well set up too. If Fallout is a massive success and they want something before they release season 2, do an anthology series because they have the sets built where every episode is set in a different vault and you explore a different vault experiment in each
one. That could be interesting. Yeah. Because I mean, that's almost kind of how they set up the first episode is as an anthology of these three different characters in a sense.
Yeah, a little bit. I'm thinking like every episode, different vault, different experiment. So maybe sometimes they end in, actually, to be frank, most vaults end in tragedy because people start insane.
Yeah, the social construct of it all of like, yeah, we're going to save you and also experiment on you.
Yeah, wild. So it'd be cool to see the vault experiments happen. There are a few vault experiments in the series coming up, which are... one of them is particularly horrifying and funny.
I'm curious if they're going to expand out into the broader world too. That's the other thing, because so much of these games are focused in Americana. I'm wondering if, as the series goes, we'll see like how did people in South Korea handle Fallout? You know, handle the end of the world or something like that. You know, like what happened out there?
Interesting you mention that because so much of Fallout is based on Americana. I know
and
that there
the
is
war
a
with China. That was the communist. Yeah, the regime.
I know that there is a fan game that is coming out in the next few, maybe in the next year, based on the Fallout 4 engine called Fallout London. That is a Fallout game set in London with a completely different culture and like corporations and organizations behind it, which looks really cool.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah,
because they have that, really that movie with Kate Beckinsale where there was like, back at where there was almost like a doomsday thing, like out, there was a whole quarantine zone outside of like London and she had to go into it. It starred Jeremy Irons was in it as well. And that's where I was thinking too, when we were talking about the Brotherhood of Steel earlier, because he has this whole medieval kingdom that he's essentially established out in like the no man's land kind of thing. Mm-hmm. He's kind of just gone back to a simpler society. That's what they haven't tried to rejoin, but there was, I forget what the name of the movie was though. Outbreak? No, it's not Outbreak, but it had something to do with some sort of and like there was it was like a nice mix of like, yeah, like Fallout Raiders, but also this medieval mindset of civilization can kind of restart as it wants to. And I was thinking about that and I was like, yeah, is that how London would do Fallout, so to speak, right? Or Britain would, rather.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Greg, thank you very much for joining me and talking about
my pleasure.
I very much enjoyed your insights into the series, both in terms of just like, the series is really good, and also your professional insights as well.
Thank you. I'm glad you consider them valid.
I every single one of them, except for your opinion about Mass Effect. I'm just going to edit that out. No, I'm not. Disagree with
Greg
me,
is wrong.
Really.
Yeah, this is not a podcast about discourse. It's a podcast where Jono is great and you say yes.
We'll see who the host is now.
I'm just going to throw my weight around.
Well, if you'd like to support my dictatorial reign here at Random Encounter and want to support us at RPG Fan, we've opened a store. You can find it at www.rpgfan.com/shop. What I would really like to draw your attention to, though, lots of cool stuff in there. But
the
John
Rules
t-shirt? Well, there's t-shirts, baby onesies, which I believe you are the, well, you aren't the proud owner of, but you are the,
we had two and they fit great because we had one for when she was littler and then we have one for now. Then they look great.
Okay. My first thought is, how the hell did you manage to get Gwen into a baby onesie? I do not imagine she was happy about that at all.
We got Gwen. Gwen does have her own RPG Fan shirt though. There's a woman's small, the pastel green one looks fantastic as well.
Cool. I have one as well, and a mug and lots of other things. What I'd like to draw your attention to, though, is our collaboration with Hyperplay RPG, the RPG fan review card collection. It's a showcase of nearly 300 of our review cards, as you can find on Instagram. I have a bunch in there. Greg, you have some in there as well.
I do. I wrote things.
I think so.
I sure did.
And it's a really cool little book. I really like it. And it's a really interesting way to find some games that you otherwise wouldn't. Let me put it this way. There was a reason why it was a lot easier to pick a game to play back in the days of Blockbuster Video, where you just go and there'd be like a bunch of RPGs on the shelf or games on the shelf. And you'd just be like, I want this one. And this kind of gives you that same. You can flip through it and be like, I've never heard of this game before and check it out. Really cool little resource. And the art in it is really great. So check that out. I also suggest
the only shame is that it doesn't get updated all the time now.
No, it doesn't. But I think that there will be updates in the future. I think we're getting enough popularity and enough sales here that we're going to be getting there'll be other versions of it, but not for quite some time.
Yeah. Until we get the next like 10 years collection.
Yeah, exactly. Also, check out our past episodes of Random Encounter. Last week, our episode, we were talking about a RPG, possibly the RPG of the year so far in terms of its running, which is Dragon's Dogma 2. And we were also talking about Lucas Pope's latest game, Mars After Midnight, on the Playdate. Interesting little game. We also have Retro Encounter. And if you want to check that out, it's a nice sister episode to this one, which is last week we talked about Fallout. So I talked about the history of the series with a panel, talked about our favorite games, what we really liked about them. That episode turned out really, really well. So I'm really pleased with that. Check that out. And we also have Rhythm Encounter, which is RPG Fans Music Podcast. Last week was focused on remasters of classic games and the rearranged music that comes with them. Cool episode, but also don't miss our April Fool's episode, which was entirely focused on our favorite sounds from RPGs. So sound effects. I loved that idea. I thought it was like in past years, we did the karaoke episode. We did the all chocobo episode. I really should have sang something from Fallout because Fallout has a hell of a soundtrack. I could have done a cover of I Don't Want to Set the World on Fire. That would have been fun. Probably not going to do that right now. Okay. If you'd like to get in contact with us here at Random Encounter, you can fire us off a message at podcast@rpgfan.com. I would absolutely love to hear from you if you have any ideas for future episodes or discussion questions or anything else you'd like to share with us. Please fire me off a message. I'd love to read it. If you'd like to send me an email directly, you can do so at jlogan@rpgfan.com. And you can also find me on Mastodon at johnologan@mastodon.social. Of course, I'm not the only person on here with an online presence. Greg, where can we find you online? Or are there any projects you'd like to tease?
Greg Delmage, you can Google me and find me anywhere from IMDb to social media. G Delmage on most everything. I'm G Delmy on our Discord. Mm-hmm. And projects that I want to tease, nothing super crazy comes to mind. You can catch me out on an episode of The Irrational. I got to play an airline pilot, even though you don't see me in a plane. I'm just getting interrogated by the police. And I have another show coming up that'll be dropping soon enough. Just did some ADR for. Is pretty neat. But no, I don't think I have anything worth teasing at the moment. So it's just life as is.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, I'm glad you're getting some work. So that's neat.
It was some stuff last year and stuff this year, and the industry's slowly coming back here in Vancouver. So there's auditions going around. Just gotta book them. Can't control too much beyond just doing the best you can.
Of course. If you enjoyed this podcast, please feel free to share it with your friends. And you can also rate us on iTunes or your other podcast player of choice, and feel free to leave us a review. Greg, again, thank you so much for joining me today and taking the time to watch the show. I know that you're going to watch the whole thing and watch the beginning again with your wife. And I really hope that you both enjoy the rest of the show, because I really did. I think it really does a great job. I think the level of quality there it continues straight through.
Yeah, I'm definitely invested and want to see where it goes, which is always a great mark for any show. And this was a good excuse to jump in sooner rather than later.
And to everyone out there listening, whatever you're playing, or in this case, watching, have fun.